RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
To MedSafe's decision to heavily restrict high-dose micronutrient supplements, just as a world-first randomized controlled trial on nutrients for women with depression and pregnancy is released through the University of Canterbury. She's been on our program before, Julia Ruckledge, PhD, Professor of Psychology and a clinical psychologist in the School of Psychology, Speech and Hearing at the University of Canterbury. The director of the Te Puna Toyota, the Mental Health and Nutrition Research Lab, theme leader in the Child Wellbeing Institute, co-author of The Better Brain, jointly published by Penguin, Random House and HarperCollins in 2021. Her interests in nutrition and mental illness grew out of research showing poor outcomes for individuals with significant psychiatric illness despite receiving standard conventional treatments. For over a decade, her lab has been running clinical trials investigating the role of broad-spectrum micronutrients in the treatment of mental illness, including ADHD, mood disorders, anxiety, and stress. Julia has over 140 peer-reviewed publications, including in The Lancet Psychiatry, JAMA, and the British Journal of Psychiatry, and is currently on the Executive Committee for the International Society of Nutritional Psychiatry Research. Julia, we had to get all that in to prove, it's like one of these random tests, trials to prove that you know what you're talking about, all right? So,
fair enough.
Anyway, welcome back to our program.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thanks for the opportunity.
World first randomized controlled trial sounds pretty impressive to me. Can you tell us about this trial, please?
Yes. And it is overall, there's a lot of stuff that we can talk about associated with it, but it is a good news story. And it's that we're interested in finding out whether or not giving micronutrients above the recommended dietary allowance, but typically below the upper limit, which is a limit that identifies it's a number that helps us know that if you go much above that limit, then you increase the likelihood of a side effect. They're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination because they're always based on single nutrient studies. And nobody normally consumes it from their diet anyway, nutrients in just one nutrient. You typically consume them in combination. But anyway, it is what it is and is what we have. Quite outdated, but it's what we had to be guided by. So we just to recognize, when you say high doses, you know, it does always sort of make people think that they might have a safety issue. And this was all vetted by MedSafe, actually, and they allowed us to do this study. So every nutrient was looked at in the dose that we were giving at, and they allowed us to go ahead and do this study.
Can I just ask you one question there?
Yeah.
Is that because of outdated limits? Mm. Or because there was a genuine side effect safety concern?
I'm not sure I understand the question. What?
Well, they allowed them, right? And
yeah.
And you mentioned that the acceptable limits couldn't be exceeded, but what they approved this trial to go to a certain level of dosage. Is that what?
Yes. They did. And in fact, a few of the nutrients were above that upper limit that's identified for a single nutrient. And we argued successfully that we were giving them above the UL for a logical reason. So, for example, the upper limit for zinc is there to prevent you from getting a copper deficiency if you were to only consume zinc by itself. But the formula contains zinc and copper. And so that restriction isn't logical in the case of a multi-nutrient formula. So
and they agree with that. They buy
they allowed us to do it. Yes, so they bought it. Yeah, it's not something to buy. I mean, they accepted the logic and allowed us to go forward.
Because you said the research is it's old, right?
The research on RDAs and the ULs is outdated. Yes.
Yeah.
So they get the one for New Zealand, I think it's 2001 was where they publish it. But RDAs anywhere around the world are based on heart health, muscle health. They don't take into consideration the brain and the brain's needs. And given that the brain is one of the most metabolically active organs, you would think that it would the RDAs would include the brain and what is optimally needed by the brain.
Why do you think the brain's been missed?
Well, why is the brain missed in everything? It's always the poor second cousin to physical health.
Well, that's a very good question. Why?
I don't. I mean, I think at some point they split the brain and the body. You know, there was this, you know, the Descartes or, you know, long time ago, philosophically, we kind of split the two and we never reintegrated them together. And it's a bit odd.
Well, we know the brain has a blood supply. It's made of meat yes. and it's connected to the rest of the body.
And it's connected to the gut, which is where, where all your food is absorbed and metabolized. So yes, it is unusual. And so it's something we need to fix as a society, is to stop identifying it as being separate from the rest, the physical body. But then, you know, we can get into the stigma and of what a mental health issue is. And we, you know, that it's okay to have cancer, but it's, you know, nobody will talk about the fact that you might have depression or schizophrenia. So we have a long way to go to try to integrate them more holistically. So, but I think that's a bigger topic than what we're talking about today. We could spend the rest of the time talking about that, but.
Okay, well, let's carry on with the study. So you got through those hoops, then what happened?
Okay, so we were interested in looking at whether or not the micronutrients could have a positive effect on the symptoms of antenatal depression. And this is partially because the treatments that are available for moms have got some challenges associated with them. For example, psychotherapy, it's hard to access it. There's, the costs that are involved. You know, all of us can talk about how hard it is to see a psychologist in Aotearoa at the moment. So there are some challenges associated with psychotherapy if you're feeling depressed. The antidepressants, that in itself is a really, really big topic. But at the bottom line is that regardless of what has been published in this space, moms are very reluctant to take them during pregnancy. About 80% of them want to come off their antidepressant when they get pregnant. So while there is reassurance from the medical community that they are safe, there is also a literature that isn't quite as saying that same story. So it depends on what you read, what weight you place on different pieces of evidence. But the bottom line is that there's never been a controlled study of antidepressants during pregnancy. So that means that there has never been a placebo-controlled trial of an antidepressant compared to a placebo during pregnancy to treat symptoms of antenatal depression. There's a reason for that. It would probably be unethical to do that. And there's also a historical thing to understand is that, and I'm starting to understand this with Ozempic, because there's all these questions around, is Ozempic safe in pregnancy? And so I suspect the same thing happened with antidepressants, was that antidepressants were being used with non-pregnant people, and then people got pregnant and they were on the antidepressant. And so then there was this kind of thing of, well, what do we do? What do we tell moms to come off of it during pregnancy? There at that time, there was no information. So I guess they went with, it was better to treat the depression, and that would outweigh any risks that might be associated with the antidepressants. So it's a really tricky subject to kind of get your head around, because it's entirely based on observational data. So meaning that now, you know, in 2025, there's been hundreds of thousands of women who have taken these drugs during pregnancy, and so they've been able to compare mothers who've taken them with mothers who haven't taken them. But there is so much difficulty in interpreting those data, because they're not always the same people, the same kind of people. The kind of people who take antidepressants are sometimes viewed as different from people who choose to not take them. Can't remember which way I said that. Yeah. But anyway, so it's really, really difficult to tease apart. And that is why it depends on what you read. You will have a different way of, the weight will be placed differently on different variables.
If there's a question over ethics in running trials, surely it's unethical to prescribe them.
Well, I'm not going to comment on that, whether or not it's ethical or unethical, because I'm not a prescriber, and I'd rather.
But what are you basing it on?
Well,
what are you basing the prescription on if there's no?
It is based on that depression, untreated depression, can lead to negative outcomes at birth. For example, it can increase the likelihood of a preterm birth. It can lead to lower birth weight babies. These are things that are identified as risk factors as that child grows up. So if you have a preterm baby, that increases your likelihood of, say, for example, having increased risk of psychiatric disorders as you get older. So those are concerns. And so the idea of giving the antidepressant is that if you can eliminate the depression, then you will that will hopefully have a better outcome.
But what if it doesn't?
What if it doesn't? I know. Well, that's why we've done this study. I mean, this study is such a good news story because it's that yes, antidepressants exist. Yes, there's certain part of the population who may benefit from them, and that if that mother hadn't been treated with that medication, then the outcome could have been much worse. So there are these complex challenges that I think that prescribers have, and I completely acknowledge those difficult decisions that both the mother and the prescriber have to make. And so I'm certainly not here to tell people not to take them. I just think that informed consent is really important.
And yeah, that's, you're right. That's where it comes
back. The bottom line. And so those are those really difficult decisions that the people have to make.
Have you heard, is there an adequate level of informed consent going on here?
I mean, I can only base that on people who we've seen, and based on what they tell us, I kind of wonder whether or not adequate informed consent has happened, but that's not fair for me to make the assumption that that's actually what was said, because we often hear things differently from what the person said.
Well, I ask that because informed consent's been trampled on big time, and if it happens once, it can happen again.
But at the end of the day, I can only have faith in some faith in humanity and the do no harm.
I used to have faith in that as well.
Yes.
So do you want to go through the mechanics of the study? And then, and what did you find? And I wonder how surprised or otherwise you were at the outcome.
Let's do that. So we've kind of touched on why did we do this. We wanted to see if there was another way forward for moms during pregnancy when they're making these difficult decisions. So we gave half of the moms, we had 88 women in the study, half of them got the micronutrients, these higher than recommended dietary allowance nutrients, and half of them got what we call an active placebo because it had iodine in it, which is the only nutrient that's required after first trimester in pregnancy in Aotearoa. Okay. So we had to have that in there because that's what is in the Ministry of Health guidelines. It also had a little bit of riboflavin in there because we think it's really important to maintain the blind of the study, which is very difficult to do if you have a lot of side effects. We don't typically see a lot of side effects with the micronutrients, but one side effect that can happen is that your urine will change color. In order to mitigate that challenge, you put a little bit of riboflavin in the placebo so that you can confidently say to the mothers, if your urine does change color, it could very well be just because we've put that one ingredient that is responsible for that color change into the placebo.
What color does it change to?
Oh, it just gets really fluorescent yellow. So it's and it doesn't happen to everyone, but it's just it was to maintain the blind, which I have to say we've managed to maintain successfully in all our trials, and that is really really important. I mean, I could spend a lot of time talking about the blind not being maintained in a lot of the antidepressant research. It's been one of the big challenges, and that's usually because people experience the side effects, and so then they know what they're on, and then that can influence the way they report their outcome. So we want to try to get rid of all these things that muddy up a randomized control trial. So we randomized them. We monitored them for 12 weeks. So that in itself is therapeutic. And I really want to emphasize this part of the study is that I call it light touch therapy because they're being monitored every couple of weeks and that they're asked to fill in some questionnaires. And then once a month, they came in to see one of my wonderful graduate students, and got that care, that attention, the interest, asked a lot of questions. It's not therapy per se, because they're not there to challenge any of their thoughts or provide them with any psychological tools, but just the listening and that empathic response in itself is therapeutic. So okay. We're really working, you know, so this is working against us finding an effect, is that we have, you know, we have this active placebo group. Which means that, so in terms of our results, so we monitored them. We also did some blood work. We also looked at the microbiome, interestingly. What we found was the good news, which is that 75% of the mothers were in remission regardless of what group they were put into. So if they were in the placebo or they were in the micronutrient group. So that means there was no difference on the self-report of depression.
However, that's interesting,
isn't it? I know it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I see that as good news. I mean, I know it's not, you know, it's showing you how strong the placebo effect is.
Yeah.
But then that in itself is really useful to kind of, I guess, again, in those situations where there might be some reluctance around, do I go for the antidepressants or not? Knowing that you can really really support moms during pregnancy by this monitoring, that is good. And that's something that it doesn't necessarily have to be done by a psychiatrist or a medical person. I mean, Midwives also provide that level of, you know, continuity of care. And so I guess it's just a real plug for saying that is really important, that monitoring of somebody's psychological functioning through its pregnancy.
I wonder, Julie, if you get the same placebo effect on the actual antidepressant medication if you thought you were taking it but weren't.
You do get a pretty strong placebo effect in the antidepressant literature as well. Yeah, yep. You do.
Okay, yep. So that's the human condition at work there.
Correct. Yes. And there's been a lot of debate about that topic in the antidepressant literature. And I can absolutely vouch for it's very strong. It exists. And those data that I just talked about prove that. However, when we looked at more holistically what was happening with those moms, and that's when the clinician is listening to, you know, what she's saying about side effects, her life, how she's coping, her stress, her sleep. So taking into consideration a whole bunch of the things outside of just mood, then the micronutrients outperformed the placebo. And so that's really good story too, because it meant that the ones who were taking the active nutrients did do better than the placebo group. However, there was I've already identified, the placebo effect was really strong. However, when we started to look at subgroups, and this is important, is that are there subgroups of moms who were only benefited if they were put on the micronutrients and they didn't experience a really strong placebo effect? And there were two variables that we found, and these were kind of interesting. One of them was, we called it personality difficulties. I'm not super in favor of that, but that's kind of what the measure assessed. And that's like being very, having a lot of maybe anger, irritability, difficulty in relationships, those types of challenges. If the mother was self-reporting more of those, she did way better if she was randomized to the micronutrients. And so then you see a really big split in our data. And so it's much stronger effect with those types of people. The
Those are people who are aware that they are, I don't know what the term would be, thinking a particular way or feeling a particular way. So they've thought about how they're feeling.
They had to give some, I mean, there was a discussion between the clinician and the mother on that one.
Okay.
So through that conversation, the clinician made a sort of a judgment on the different questions that are in that questionnaire. The second one was whether or not she had a past history of being on a psychiatric medication. So if that mother had tried a psychiatric medication prior to her pregnancy before, she was more likely to benefit from the micronutrients. Oh. That's a good news story, because again, that reluctance of wanting to take the antidepressants during pregnancy, those moms needed, in order for the response to happen, they needed to be on the active ingredients. Right. So that's again a really good news story for those who are, they might be doing well on the antidepressants, but or they haven't done well on the antidepressants. We think that that's probably a proxy for not doing well on antidepressants, but that's not necessarily a fair thing to say, because we don't know why those moms moms weren't on it. So, but that's kind of an assumption you can make. So, or that the side effects were, when, you know, they might have responded, but they didn't like the side effects. So there could be a whole bunch of reasons why they weren't on it. So that's also a good news story. The other good news story is that some of the markers, we looked at some biological markers, we had, you were less likely to get deficient in nutrients if you were on the micronutrients. Now that makes sense. Yeah, but it also highlighted for me though, was that what I didn't realize until we did this research is that, and this isn't surprising, I just hadn't really thought about it, is that as that fetus grows, it depletes, deplete mom of nutrients. And so she becomes more and more depleted over time. So what the micronutrient arm was doing was keeping her steady, was keeping those levels steady. They weren't going up massively, which we have seen in our studies in non-pregnant populations. But here it was keeping her steady. So that is also a really good news story, because it's not surprising that a pregnancy is really going to challenge that mother's ability to get adequate amounts of nutrients. And then you compound that with the diet that she might be eating, which, you know, in Aotearoa, the data are really not great in terms of adherence to the dietary regular, you know.
Did you include that, the sort of mapping out?
Yeah,
the diet?
We did. We didn't. It's hard to do, and I'm not a dietitian, so we didn't do it in a really in-depth way. So there's probably going to be a lot of people who would criticize what we did. But based on what, you know, the questionnaire that we did use, which has been used in other studies, only 10% of them would be identified as sort of being in a good nutritional zone.
Only 10%.
I know. But I know. Wow. But the growing up in New Zealand data is that only 3% of moms adhere to the dietary recommendations and by the Ministry of Health.
Boy, 3% is almost the margin of error.
I know, it's tiny. I mean, and we're not doing well at the population level. So it is something that I really am advocating for and really trying to get some attention to, is that. We really need to address the fact that moms are eating quite poorly during pregnancy, and with the cost of living crisis, that's getting worse. And I, as a nation who should care about its citizens, and particularly the next generation, we should be doing everything that we can to make sure that all mothers have equal opportunity to have access to real whole foods. I mean, that's just as an aside. That's just, yeah.
There are ways of doing that.
Of course, there are ways of doing that. I mean, it just changed the fiscal levers that influence the cost of food. Everything can be changed. To me, it's a little bit surprising is that United States have done some study, have done voucher programs where they give vouchers to moms at risk.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, yeah. And that has been really positive both for mom and the outcomes of those kids. They're more likely to get good reading levels. They're less likely to get diagnosed with neurodevelopmental conditions, et cetera, et cetera. So there's really great outcomes when those kinds of initiatives have been implemented. I've done my best to bring this to the attention of our current politicians and our current Minister of Mental Health, particularly as part of his portfolio of 25% of his fund is supposed to go to prevention, and that would be a beautiful way to prevent mental health issues.
Okay, so you'd think they'd jump at it.
I used to think that people would jump at all my data, but I've come to
the conclusion. What's the use of being someone in charge of mental health at government level and you kind of don't do anything? What's the point of even having you?
I think that his focus at the moment is on having more ambulances at the bottom of the cliff. So he's increasing the number of clinical psychologists that are trained in Aotearoa at the moment. That's been the focus.
But how can you counsel? Probably that's a bit of a lightweight word, someone who has a nutritional deficiency. I mean, how can you psychotherapy your way out of that?
I think everybody would benefit from making sure that they had adequate nutrient levels. We would all benefit. We'd all be less irritable. Our sleep would be better. We'd be able to concentrate more. And we would be ultimately be more resilient to when stressors come along. So I think it's such a vital component of being human and being a healthy and resilient human. And it's just that it's taking a while for that kind of information to filter through. We know about, I mean, going back to the beginning of the conversation, we know that for physical health, I mean, not that everybody necessarily adheres to it, but I think most people would know that diet is nutritional environment is really important if you want to make sure you have a healthy heart or to avoid type 2 diabetes, or at least I assume that people know that what they're eating is influencing those.
No, outcomes. They don't. I'm telling you that most don't.
Cancer. Anyway, endometrial cancers, we know that that's very much influenced by the dietary environment or the nutritional environment. So it is super important. And yes, you can get sinister and you can think there's a lot of players that influence governments and there's a lot of big players. And one of them is the big for food. So, you know, I've got big food and big pharma are going to be not so happy about
this. But
wouldn't
you say, Julie, if you're spending over $1 billion on mental health, I think that's the ballpark, mm-hmm. maybe even more than that, mm-hmm. that you could just lop off, you know, a couple of hundred mil, you know?
Well, look what happened to the lunches, which you and I talked about a while ago. Yeah. The expectation that you can, with a very, very small budget, you can feed kids really nourishing foods. There's a lack of understanding about how the quality really matters.
Is there anything more to say about the study before we I'll raise a few other things?
So in doing this study, I learned really early on that nobody wanted to refer their moms to us. So that means that, we were quite a little bit surprised by that. So it's not to say that there weren't.
When you say they refused to, who are you talking about refusing to refer? So
health professionals who are involved in care of women during pregnancy. So, and it's not to say that there weren't some who were, who sent lots of mothers to us, but there was definitely a reluctance and there was a concern that was raised with us really early on that the nutrients could very well be dangerous. And so, and that was, you know, there wasn't a lot I could say against that. Like we had provided a lot of safety data to MedSafe. MedSafe had allowed us to do the study. So, you know, that was reassurance to us that they didn't identify any reason why the study shouldn't go ahead. There wasn't a nutrient and dose that concerned them. But in all fairness, kind of like the antidepressants, there hadn't been a controlled trial. And so it was reasonable for people to be cautious, kind of like, we've got the prenatals. The prenatal supplements are in doses that are much lower than what we were using. And so there was, you know, this was the first study. So, of course, the people are going to be a little bit cautious on that one. So I took that as actually an opportunity to say, okay, we're not just going to look at efficacy, we're going to look at safety. And all our studies, we look at safety. We always look at side effects in the randomized controlled trial. But in this one, it was different because we could follow those infants who were exposed to the micronutrients during pregnancy. So we quickly sort of reorganized the study. I mean, the randomized controlled trial piece was intact and it stayed as it was. But we thought in order for us to be able to contextualize the outcomes, the birth outcomes, infant outcomes, we needed to recruit a group of mums who were not taking those micronutrients during the pregnancy. So we recruited mums who were pregnant, who were, some of them were just not depressed, and they a lot of them took the standard supplements that are on offer, like Elevate, those kinds of pregnancy supplements, but they weren't taking the micronutrients that we were studying. But in the process of doing that, we also ended up with a group of mums who were taking antidepressants. So we had an opportunity of being able to compare the outcomes of the micronutrient infants and birth outcomes which I would call standard care, because antidepressants would be perceived as part of standard care. They are recommended in more severe cases of depression, which was ours were more moderate, although we did have some severe cases in our study, but most of them were more like mild to moderate. But the 3% of moms in New Zealand take antidepressants during pregnancy. So it is something you think about 60,000 births per year, then you kind of go, oh, well, actually there's quite a few. I could do the math quickly for you on that one, but so I used to know it, but you know, I can't keep hold of all of numbers, which means that there's about 1,800 moms every year who are taking antidepressants. So that was so those were comparison groups. They're not perfect, Paul. Anyone will say they're not randomized. So, you know, how do you know?
But you can't get that anyway in the real world, right? No.
You can't do that.
It's an impossibility.
It is impossible. And so it was the best that we could do. But we did get a whole bunch of information about all these different moms, which are at least allow you to say, are they generally equivalent on other variables? And that's things like your age and your socioeconomic status and whether or not you were a smoker, whether or not you drank alcohol before the pregnancy, whether or not you'd had previous children, those types of demographic variables that help us determine whether or not there was equivalence across those three groups. And generally there was, and in any area where there wasn't equivalence, it was disadvantaging the micronutrient group to find a difference. Okay. So for example, there were more previous smokers in the micronutrient group. And we know that smoking influences birth outcomes and that they're more likely to be low birth weight babies. And so that meant it's working against finding an effect. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, I get that.
So it wasn't that these were like all the moms in the micronutrient group were, I don't know, like, you know, highly educated.
Angels.
Her angels. They weren't. They were just regular people. So, the other groups consisted of regular people too. So there wasn't anything that suggested that could have been a better explanation for the differences that we did observe. Okay. So the birth outcomes. So we've just published these data. They just came out last week. It has been really hard to publish these data.
Why?
I'll just say that. Because we have data on the effects of antidepressants on birth outcomes that will not be popular.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I can only say that because, and I base that on the reviewer comments on why the study kept getting rejected, what the editors were saying. So, I got a pretty strong message that publishing these data was dangerous. We were being dangerous as researchers. So,
hang on. What?
I'm sorry,
that sounds like medieval.
I'm just telling you what we were told.
I know, but.
Yeah, okay. I know. Don't worry. I appealed the decision, but I didn't win. So I have seen a side of the world that is less than.
I can hear it in your voice, Julia. You're not happy with that.
It's just to be honest, it's just exhausting when all you're doing is presenting data. I'm happy for someone to replicate it and prove us wrong.
Yeah.
But to try to prevent the data from being published because they didn't like the results.
These are the people who tell us to follow the science all the time.
I don't. We never know who the reviewers are because they're always the peer review process is always anonymous, so we don't know who they are.
So this is more like a PR consideration.
I don't know what you mean.
Well, in the messaging,
I'm trying really hard in my messaging. Hopefully, you can hear it in the way I'm describing it to you. Is that but the data are what they are. And so what we found was that this is a really good news story though, Paul. And that's why it's been so frustrating that it's taken us so long to publish. I've known about these data now for 3 years and they just came out. Yeah. So it's not that I haven't tried, believe me, I am not one to give up. nor are my students. And so we just kept going and we got there eventually. We got it published in a really decent journal, Journal of Clinical Psychopharmacology. So it finally got a good home. And so there were some sensible reviewers there who saw the benefit. So what did we find was that the risks that are associated with untreated depression were completely mitigated by the nutrients, meaning that we had on par levels of premature birth in our micronutrient group compared to our non-depressed, the ones that weren't taking antidepressants, sort of your reference group of non-depressed moms. Mm-hmm. And so that's good news story because there were some premature births. We had 5.6% were premature. Just to give you the context, in Aotearoa, the number is 7.9%.
Lower than the average.
Lower than the average in this country. So that's really good. But there were some other really interesting findings. There was much lower likelihood of the kids getting resuscitated compared to standard care, the antidepressant group. There was less likely to have postpartum hemorrhaging. What we did was we got the birth records. So the birth records provide you with a whole bunch of information on whether or not there was blood loss, if it was a vaginal birth, or whether or not there was any resuscitation required for the infant. All of these things that are sort of standard things that they're going to record, Apgar scores, those kinds of things. So that's how we know about premature births and gestational age and weight. Interestingly, the kids who were born to the micronutrients were 2.2 centimeters. I might be getting this wrong. It might be only 2 centimeters. Let's say about 2 centimeters longer than the kids who were exposed to the antidepressants during pregnancy. There was, as I said, there was less likely to have postpartum hemorrhaging in the micronutrient group, which was significantly lower than both that reference group of moms without depression and the standard care group. So that's also really interesting finding that we didn't expect. But then when you think about it, some of the nutrients in there, like the vitamin K, may well have assisted with that. Lowering of that risk. So they were not statistically more likely to be heavier, but they were, they were longer and they were heavier. But the heavier one wasn't statistically significant, but it was trending in the right direction. So in everything that we looked at, if there was any group difference, it was favoring the micronutrients compared to the standard care. In the standard care group, our rate of preterm birth was 20%. So now, acknowledging it's a small sample, there were only 20 babies in that group, but it's still the gestational age was about a week earlier with the standard care compared to the micronutrient group. Yeah. So there's all these indicators that we know are going to either launch that baby to a really great start to life. We're all in the right direction for the nutrients. And remember, the reason why we did this was because there were so many people concerned about the risks. And so we really looked at risk, and this was one way that we could really do that in a fairly systematic and fair way, because these were just the data that came. We didn't influence them. These came from the birth records. And then the story gets even better. And that is that when we looked at the infants, we did some really early measures and indicators of the child's ability to regulate their world, their environment, their emotions and reaction to the world, orient themselves, their reflexes, their motor coordination, their ability to pull up, to sit, all of these early indicators of competency. The micronutrient infants were either on par or better, and in a number of cases they were significantly better than that reference group, and in almost every single way we looked at it, they were a lot more competent than those infants born to the moms with antidepressants. So there is one thing that is acknowledged that can happen when moms have taken antidepressants in pregnancy and the impact it can have on the infant. And that is neonatal adaptation syndrome. And so that's kind of like when the baby comes out and it's had this exposure to the medication and it's no longer exposed to the medication. There can be a certain period of time where there's some adaptation that needs to happen. So that can possibly explain why there's sometimes a bit more difficulty in terms of that need for resuscitation, for example. The 45% of them needed resuscitation in the standard care group. Yeah. And I'm trying to remember the number. I think it was about 15% in the micronutrient group. I feel like I have to confirm that one with you. Anyway, I can easily find that. So
every outcome was better.
Either on par with that that standard. Or it was better. Yeah. So it was so reassuring. And when we were analyzing these data, we were so thrilled that we had done this study, which we think was incredibly well, done and also done during COVID, if I can just add complexity into it, throw that in, that we were really, really thrilled and really wanted to get the data out, but it just took us a lot longer than any one of us could expect.
Running up on time, yes, I want to ask you about MedSafe in just a moment. But what's the reaction? Okay, we're talking, but being published like you have now, have you been getting incoming phone calls and emails?
Not a lot. I think I have actually been disappointed with the lack of exposure that the study is getting internationally. And I don't know why. I don't know why it's not getting picked up the way I was hoping that it would get picked up. So yes, I was right about that resuscitation. It was 15% and it was about 26% in the non-depressed sort of standard, and then it was 45%.
That's huge. That's huge, isn't it?
It is huge. It is a big difference. Like, I can only hope that this is picked up by moms who are pregnant and are making some of those choices.
Speaking to that, why at the same time, is this a strange coincidence, I wonder, are MedSafe restricting high dose micronutrients right now?
Yes. The story there is that in mid-September, so by mid-September, part of our studies have been published, not the one that I just described about the birth outcomes. That one only just came out this week. But some of those outcomes had come out. In mid-September, MedSafe contacted the distributor who sells the micronutrients in New Zealand and threatened him with a very large fine and prison for selling the nutrients.
Is this Hardy's Daily Essential Nutrients?
And there's a local distributor.
Okay.
So yes, it was the Daily Essential Nutrients. Now, there's some things I need to make sure that are really clear. One of them is that we used a dose of 12 pills a day. 4-3 times a day in the NutriMum study. In our other studies where we've shown efficacy, so for example, ADHD, we used between 8 and 12 pills a day. And so you can argue that it has therapeutic benefit. And that's an important word when it comes to medications in this country. But it is sold in New Zealand as a supplement, as a dietary supplement, and it is recommended dose on the bottle is 4 pills a day. So pills a day has never been shown to be therapeutic because we have used much higher doses. You need more, yeah. So what they got, what MedSafe legally was able to do was say that there were 3 nutrients at the 4 pills a day that violated the dietary supplement regulations of 1985. And one of the nutrients, lithium, is considered a prescribed medication at any dose. And one of the nutrients contained in one of the versions of Daily Essential Nutrients contains a very, very small amount of lithium.
But don't they use lithium anyway to treat
bipolar.
In this area? Yeah.
Yes, yes. But the dose, that first of all, they're using a different form, which is lithium carbonate, and the form that's used in the daily essential nutrients is lithium orotate. That can mean that influences the how much lithium you're going to get out of it. But the doses of the lithium that you're going to get out of lithium carbonate when it's prescribed is much higher than what you'd get out of it as a dietary supplement. So you'd be getting the typical standard dose that now is about, can vary from 250 milligrams up to a gram or even more in the lithium carbonate version, but the lithium orotate is below a gram, below a milligram it contained within the daily essential nutrients. Now, there's slight differences around how much lithium is in lithium orotate and lithium carbonate, but regardless, you're talking about, tens of times lower dose. So that dose has never been shown to be therapeutic. But MedSafe, because it's listed as a medicine one of the supplements to the Medicines Act of 1981. I know. It's been in there for a long, 84.
Or 85. I was still just out of being a teenager, and I'm 61 now.
Yeah. So it was named as a medication back then, and it hasn't been changed or updated based on that. Well, actually, there should be a dose. Why not allow lithium as a dietary supplement in Aotearoa? It's just not allowed. And yet lithium is such an important essential micronutrient that all be allowed to. So they're basically restricting it unless it's prescribed. So this has led to, I just want to make sure that was understood, is that the dose that's been sold is different from the dose that we have used therapy in our trials.
Yeah.
The other two issues were zinc and B12. The zinc at four pills a day is 1 milligram over what is stated in the dietary supplement regulations of 1985. I don't know why they chose 15 milligrams, but they did, and there's 16 milligrams in four pills. The B12, there's a limitation of 50 micrograms of B12. There is no reason to have a limit on B12 at all because there's no UL. Remember, I was talking about those upper limits? There is no upper limit to B12 because it's a water-soluble vitamin, so you eliminate anything that you don't need. So there's no safety concern whatsoever for B12 at all. The safety concern for zinc, of course, is the copper that I already mentioned. When you take it with copper, there's no say that becomes that changes. So that number changes. So they're applying the law. They stated that because those two nutrients were above what is allowed in the dietary supplements, 1985, they actually then declared it an unapproved medicine. I'm not sure I understand. I don't understand why they could do that, because just because a dietary supplement violates the dietary supplement regulations of 1985. I didn't know that suddenly made something a medicine. And it is regulated as a food, so technically it should be MPI.
Well, this is how they categorize everything and silo everything, right?
Well, I don't understand that logic, and I certainly haven't gotten that answer out of MedSafe. I mean, I think that the sad thing here is it sounds really like a war between, almost like the nutrient company and then me, the academic, and MedSafe, whereas I really think we should all be on the same team because we're
United
here.
Nations.
Well, in that MedSafe.
Well, that's because it is a kind of a war. It is.
But
it's a war against orthodoxy.
Yes.
Orthodoxy and kind of, like I said before, siloed thinking.
That's right. But for me, the reason why I keep talking about it, I mean, it makes it sound like I'm funded by the company, and I'm not. I am here to advocate for the consumer. And so the reason why I keep wanting to bring this issue to attention is that the consequence of this is that it's made it much harder for the consumer to access the nutrients that we've studied.
Yeah.
MedSafe say it's easy issue to solve. All you need to do is have it go through their medicine route and then get it licensed as a medicine.
How much
and
does
then
that cost?
Have it prescribed. My understanding is about $50,000 for the application. However, it costs even more because, and this is where it's like insane, or lots of it is insane, actually, some of it, but is that because daily essential nutrients is a dietary supplement and is allowed to be a dietary supplement in the U.S. where it's made, the company would have to change the facility that they use it in, which is a GMP facility, to a pharmaceutical grade facility in order for them to even start the application to MedSafe.
Right.
And the reason for that is it's because it's being considered as a medicine, so it has to be made in a medicine type facility. So you can imagine that for a small company to do that would incur a huge cost. And so the cost of the supplement is going to of this intervention, whatever, is going to massively go up. There's no guarantee that it would then, first of all, get accepted as a medicine here, but second of all, there's no guarantee it's going to get funded. And that's, at the end of the day, what I care about is an expensive option. There's no route in our system for it to be easily funded. There are some people who have had it funded through WINS, but they have to apply on an individual basis. So there's no easy route for this to happen. There's no route for dietary supplements to get easily funded in Aotearoa. Pharmac is all about medicines. So that's their only route. So they're saying, we're not stopping this from being sold here. You have to go through our legal
route. We've just made the
route.
Bar so high that it's not really possible to do.
It just means it's different. And the other option that they have said is that, well, if it gets imported into Aotearoa by a pharmaceutical grade facility that is willing to sell it here, then they will, you know,
that would compete against
route.
Their own product, potentially.
Well, but they're also, because of the, if you have something that's been researched and has been shown to be therapeutic, it basically can be sold on as an unapproved medicine, but an unapproved medicine can't be advertised. And so now we've got this situation. Nobody knows it's there.
Yeah.
So the only person who can actually talk about it is me, which is not a great position to be in, to be honest. I'd rather be able to keep going with the research, but I understand the importance of it. Because the supplier can't advertise it, the company can't say it's got any therapeutic benefit. But as somebody at an academic institution who's not involved in the sale of it or hasn't got any shares or anything like that, then I can talk about our data. There's no, I'm not restricted on talking about my data.
Wow,
I know.
Like I say, it's a great news story. It's. Yeah, on every level, as you've told us.
Well, I just wish it wasn't so difficult. At the end of the day, this is going to take ages to find some kind of suitable way forward. And in the interim, the data should be available now. They should be provided to mums who are pregnant right now, making those as an option. Here's the antidepressants. Here's what we know. There's this intrigue, you know, there's micronutrients. There's been one study done, which, to be honest, is more than's ever been done on antidepressants. But, you know, I feel like I'm whatever the word is, lost my train of thought. But anyway, is that they do have that this other option, and here's the data, and published in really, you know, at the end of the day, in reasonable journals.
I know which one I'd take.
So, but it is more expensive. The antidepressant will be completely free and covered by public health care, but the micronutrients won't. So it's going to, and so for me, that's an equity issue. It's just a...
Yeah, no, good point. Yeah.
It's, so even if it was allowed to be talked about, there
You've
is still
You've got to have disposable
equity.
Income to be able to have it.
And I did not do this research just for the wealthy. I did it for everyone.
Yeah. Well, it's been fascinating hearing about it. Julia, thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
And just a reminder, people can find the Better Brain Book at thebetterbrainbook.com, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure.
Amazon.
All right. Thanks for coming back on, Julia.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.